Hello, everybody. Thanks for joining us again on Streamlines, your source for water knowledge. I'm your host, John McMain.
And I'm Anthony Bly.
And this is episode 14, the second part of our soil health and drainage discussion with Dr. Eileen Kladivko. I'll let her reintroduce herself.
This is Eileen Kladivko. I'm a professor in the agronomy department at Purdue University.
And just as a reminder, she is fortunately an expert in the two topics we're discussing today, soil health and drainage, which is a really good combination. And if you missed part one last week, we encourage you to check it out. We discussed kind of the relationship between drainage and soil health and talked about kind of how water moves from the surface down through the soil profile. And we discussed water table issues, how to address those and other issues potentially related to drainage. Today, we'll be discussing solutions to some of those issues, some newly studied aspects of soil health potential benefits, and more. One of the things we talked about last week was this continuum from the kind of natural system, our natural prairie, to the agricultural dominated system, and some of the, I guess, ecosystem services that we may lose or gain as we move along that continuum. So one of the questions I asked Eileen, this is kind of how we'll kick things off for this episode, is there a win-win-win situation for habitats, agronomic, and water quality aspects? And this is what she had to say.
I think for sure drainage and soil health are very compatible, and they help each other out. And we've kind of talked about that. If you drain the soil, then you can grow better crops, better cover crops, you can do no-till better, you get more roots, the roots feed the organisms build the soil, then the water moves in the soil better. And so it's a circle that kind of helps each other. For habitat purposes, if you need crop residues, if you need growth of plants of some sort, whether that be cover crops or, you know, food plots or cash crops, if you need drainage and you put drainage in, then you're going to get better growth of those plants. So I think there is a win-win-win because get better growth of the plants that you're trying to get.
How far back to the natural system can we get while remaining within the agronomic system?
Yeah, I don't know the real answer to that question, John. I mean, soil health can help drainage and drainage can help soil health. And anytime we can filter water better and use that water better, it's good for everything, including, like she just mentioned, the residues on top of the soil for whatever that may be, growing pheasants or whatever, other wildlife, other purposes. The soil life is benefiting from having a more moderated soil water regime. You know, not excessively wet and then dry and then wet, then dry. It's more moderated. And so it just improves that cycle, if you will.
Okay. What about ducks?
What about ducks? Yeah. I mean, we go back to like the last episode where maybe we talked about wetlands and their importance. We just have to decide where we want to grow our food and where we don't, and where we need those wetlands to filter water for lakes or whatever reason, water systems, aquifers or whatever.
Right.
Then, we have to decide where that is the most important.
And value that.
Right.
And keep it.
Keep that value.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
And recognize that is that's the reason that that's there.
Yeah.
That wetland is in that place.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah. We got to get there.
Right. So you talk a lot about soil health to a lot of different people, and there's a lot of benefits, I would
Correct.
Say.
Yep.
And there's a lot of benefits, not just from ecosystem services perspective, but also from an agronomic productivity perspective. Mm-hmm. You're more resilient to extremes, endless, I wouldn't say an endless list, but a long list. So one thing that has always, and this is, again, getting back to the kind of the social science side, which I'm not a social scientist, unfortunately, but I am fortunate to work with some really good ones. But I wanted to hear Eileen's opinion, and we'll talk about this after we hear the clip. But with all these benefits, why are we not seeing more uptake of these practices? So this is what she had to say.
I usually talk about this in my cover crop talks. I say, man, if this is such a good thing, why isn't everybody doing it yet? So I understand the question. And there's a couple of reasons. There's probably many reasons, but a couple of the big ones are a lot of the soil health practices. So for example, cover crops, there's a short-term cost, but most of the time there's not a short-term economic gain. So it does cost you something to actually buy seed and seed a cover crop. You might be able to get cost share from NRCS or others. But then the improvements that occur in soils don't occur immediately. And so you don't see a short-term economic gain in many instances. Okay, now in some instances you do. I mean, if you can graze the cover crop or if your soil was in really bad condition, you know, you plant a cover crop 1 year and you're already going to see an economic benefit. But in a lot of cases, you don't see a short-term economic benefit. So that's one reason. Another reason is that there is a learning curve, and a lot of folks either aren't interested or are a little concerned. They've heard of somebody who did this and it failed miserably. Well, a lot of times that's because they either didn't do their homework or they didn't get good advice or they didn't talk to other farmers or other researchers or other extension or NRCS who have done it and who could have said, you know, could say, you got to be careful about this particular thing. Right. And if you're just starting, maybe you should try this instead of that. And here's the reasons why. So there is a learning curve. And then, of course, you know, there's psychology and sociology. If people are reasonably happy with what they're doing, then why should they put the extra management and extra time into trying something new? You know, some people thrive on trying something new every year. Other people are like, I got something that's working for me. Leave me alone. So there's a host of reasons. I do want to say the economics, the Soil Health Institute recently did some studies where they essentially did case studies and interviewed 100 different farmers across the Midwest, and South Dakota was one of them. I don't know how many of the farmers were from South Dakota, but they're doing webcasts on their Soil Health Institute reports on economics. But I'm very curious to see, you know, what some of the individual states found. I know they found that there was a lot more economic gain than what most people were aware of. Of course, that's with the people that they interviewed. But I think if enough of the farmers are out there showing where they have economic gain and that you don't necessarily have to wait 10 years to see the economic gain, I think that may help more people decide to give it a try.
What do you think about that, Anthony?
She's spot on. Yeah. She's explaining the socioeconomic implications of adopting this.
Yeah.
And it's about where everyone is at, how they think.
Okay.
Their position in life, the time in life,
yeah,
all of those things,
yeah,
drive this adoption.
So you work with, I'd say, quite a few early adopters. What's kind of been their conversation about this, of why they maybe tried something new?
I think the common thread is about long-term sustainability of their farm.
Okay.
They see the importance of paying it forward for their economic implications on their natural resources.
Okay.
And they see that that is probably going to come out sometime later. And that's why they're investing in their farm with these types of practices.
Sure. What was their specific resource concern? Is it erosion or just kind of general goodness for water quality and kind of the whole suite of potential improvements?
I think it's the suite of building soil.
Okay.
Getting water in the ground, preventing water loss through evaporation, soil biology, nutrient cycling is improved, all of those things. I don't think there's any one reason.
Yeah, it does change the whole system and all those functions. One of the things is, going back to the economic piece, one thing I do hear is economics is an easy reason to not do something, right? Well, it doesn't make me money, so why would I do it?
Correct.
And of course, we can get into the discussion about the value of some of the ecosystem services. Like, right, a wetland doesn't provide you any monetary value, but it provides a lot of good for society and environment. And downstream, it provides economic benefits. There's maybe less flooding and less nutrients loss and things like that. But anyway, so I hear economics used as an easy reason to not do something, but it's not the only answer. Because there are some practices that I talk about that will make someone money. They will improve either resilience, if it's controlled drainage or drainage water recycling or whatever the case would be, but it's not the only reason that someone doesn't implement something, right? It's an easy reason to not, but it's positive economics isn't always the driving force that would cause someone to do something.
We're into a system where the short-term economics drives the cart. I mean, if you have to borrow that money, you have to pay interest on that money.
Sure.
You're motivated by that annual return.
Sure.
And the long term is, how do you think about that if you're not going to have the land or know that you're going to have the land
right
in 3 years, sure, or 5 years, or even 2 years.
Yeah, it may not pay off for you if it's not your land.
Correct.
Yeah.
Right. So there is an issue with that. Yep.
You know, a lot of times I'm critical personally of incentive payments or equip, you know, to put in cover crops, things like that, federal support or state support or support from Pheasants Forever, whatever the case would be, because I don't want a farmer to do something because they're getting paid to do it. I want them to do it because it actually works for their operation and things like that, right? But the benefit of incentive payments is it helps you get over that hurdle. So you don't see a short-term economic hit. And so then you can actually realize some long-term economic gains. And so you can get off the incentive payments because your long-term economic picture is good. You just need it to get through the short term.
Sadly, I think, though, we've trained society or producers in general to think they need an incentive payment to do something because, sure, there is a monetary loss. So you see what I'm saying, yep, is there must be a monetary loss because they're giving me an incentive payment.
Sure. Gotcha.
If it was so great, I could just do it. And so here's this result that we get, people expecting an incentive payment to do something. And so while it was good to show them, give them a chance to show them that they can do it, I think the unintended consequence was they expect it.
Sure.
Or it implies that it's going to cost me money. I can't make money doing this. And so that's why they're giving me the incentive payment to do it.
I hadn't thought of that second point of the implication of getting money for it means, yeah, you have to offset a loss to do it. And so you have to have the incentive. That's a tough one. Do you think we'll ever get out of that cycle?
I would love to see us get out of that cycle, you know, have folks realize that they can do it and it's the right thing to do,
right,
but it's just difficult.
So we had a watershed meeting recently in the Willow Creek watershed, and you were part of that. And we had a handful of farmers there that are involved in the project. And one of the things they brought up, and you brought up too, is depending on where you're at in your career. So if you're early in your career, your margins are a lot tighter. You're probably renting land versus owning land, and it's harder maybe for you to go too far out of your comfort zone. Would you say that's true?
I see the younger people more excited about alternative practices.
Interesting.
But they are more constrained by their economic position. I see older people as less excited, like, I only have so many years left,
sure,
at this. Why should I change? And so it would be great to have the older folks fostering this change process, you know, seeing it as something that maybe, boy, if I would have known this 35, 40 years ago when I started in this, if I would have known this and done this, just think where I would be now.
Sure.
That's kind of the way it should be to really push that forward strongly enough.
It's harder for them to take a risk because the implications, if that risk doesn't pay off, I mean, they could go out of business a lot more easily than someone who has the wealth or owns land, things like that.
Correct.
One of the other things that Eileen talked about was the learning curve.
So many folks look at soil health practices as a panacea or, you know, it's going to solve all their problems. And actually, it requires a lot more attention to detail.
So will we ever get to the point that we can standardize soil health recommendations, would you say, or is it going to continue to be case by case?
I hope we can. I talk about the transition between inorganic agronomy and organic agronomy. And I hope that realization someday comes true, because can we use our decision making based upon what we see in the soil as far as what the biology is doing?
Okay. So learning curve for the whole society.
Correct.
Can you explain what you mean by a transition from inorganic to organic?
Well, basically, inorganic chemistry was developed hundreds of years ago with the discovery of the elements, the basic elements.
Sure.
And so science kind of focused on those, and that's the inorganic side of, yep, of what we do. And we learned to measure them in the soil, and we studied the response of nitrogen application or phosphorus application, the response of crops to those, and soil test. All along doing that while the soil biology was there doing its own thing. We knew it had an impact, but but we couldn't measure it. And now the organic side, that's what I call the organic side, is knowing what that biology is going to do or how it's going to react
sure.
when we do a certain practice. So that's that transitioning that I'm trying to explain.
From just looking at the, I guess, chemical side to including biological side.
Yeah, and I hate to say chemical side because okay. all of these things are from the earth or our atmosphere. We've just learned to concentrate them in forms that we can deliver and apply more efficiently.
Maybe I should say chemistry side rather than chemical side.
Right.
Chemical's a loaded word.
It is a loaded word, and it's got strong negative connotations that I don't think it's quite deserving
sure.
of, but it has evolved that way.
So kind of to summarize that, and I know we've talked about this issue on the podcast, of my conservation practice didn't work, I wasted time and money, and now that becomes their personal barrier to any further experimentation.
It's tragic because you have to mentally overcome that to keep going in that direction that you want
to
go.
To try new things. And yeah. So I'm really glad Eileen brought up those potential barriers or reasons that why people don't implement practices. And you've brought in some great discussion too, Anthony, about kind of the need for trustworthy mentors, the need for experimentation type of mindset, as well as having the capacity to do that. I mean, and like you said, it can be a barrier for younger farmers or less established farms. So I then had Eileen give her perspective on kind of some of the things that are unknown or newly studied in the realm of soil health.
Well, really, soil health, the new things that are happening in soil health are really more focused on the biology. But the biology can affect things like water relations as well. So my favorite biological organism in the soil, the earthworms, if you have adequate drainage in the system, then I don't know exactly in your area of South Dakota what your earthworm population may be because in many cases you're too dry. But if you're talking about drainage, you're not necessarily too dry. So biological populations like earthworms do better where there is adequate drainage. And earthworms are very important for building soil porosity. The deep burrowing earthworms are important for getting water flow down, you know, deeper into the soil profile, for opening up channels that roots can then follow, providing nutrients that the roots can tap into. So the biology can affect the physics, particularly with the fauna. And then I would say there's probably work related to the physical properties as affected by, I mean, it's not brand new, but work on no-till or other reduced till systems and work on cover crops and how they impact soil structure and soil permeability and how quickly do those properties change and what are some of the management changes that you might do with the cover and no-till in order to really accentuate that. That all feeds into the soil health. But I'd say the biology is probably the main focus of a lot of the soil health work.
Do you think we're just at the tip of the iceberg for biology?
I do, because they're discovering new species almost daily. And if we talk about a billion microorganisms in a handful of soil or whatever however we describe that.
Right.
And they only know about 50,000 or 100,000.
Right.
Let's even stretch it to a quarter of a million.
Yeah.
You still have several million left to go. And how that quorum sensing and what signals they look for and what's important to have, we don't know that and how that happens. That's why I say we're just transitioning from inorganic agronomy to organic agronomy.
So here's a question. This may be a contentious question, but how much do we need to know about that? And maybe that's question one. And question two is, will we ever get to the point of knowing enough about the system, or will we rely on kind of machine learning and AI systems to tell us how they respond without necessarily knowing how they work, if that makes sense?
Well, I know this gets away from drainage, but just the nutrient cycling aspect and drainage impacts that, we know that very well. Can we divorce ourselves from reliance on nitrogen fertilizers? Can we use soil biology to just do that for us?
For nitrogen fixation and things like that?
Exactly.
Actually optimize the system to fix nitrogen from the atmosphere Would you also incorporate different crop rotations into that, or would you say focus on the biology for corn and beans, or do you think it has to be a more complex system?
I think it has to be more diverse. I think it has to involve cover crops. It has to involve crop rotation. It has to involve all of that. But can we grow a corn crop 1 out of 4 years?
Sure.
It's just a number I'm throwing out today.
Right.
There's nothing hard and fast.
Yep.
But if we could grow a corn crop 1 out of 4 years without any nitrogen inputs, where would that put us as far as our environment, our economics? I mean, that puts us at the top of the list there. I mean, that's a pretty impressive achievement.
I would be impressed. So thinking about the natural prairie or native prairie, that was not a leaky system. Or I shouldn't say it wasn't a leaky system. The leakage at the bottom for nutrients was much less.
Was contained. Right.
And so in essence, we had a balance. And there was no addition, right? Well, I shouldn't say that, because there was an addition through livestock integrated. I mean, through
When the bison came along, they added. Yeah.
Yeah.
And they also caused that productivity to go up, because that grazing caused a response, right?
Yeah. So, okay. We don't have the bison across the landscape, which this is a very big digression, but my brother lives in Tanzania. I went to Tanzania. I was very fortunate to go see the Serengeti. And you go out on the Serengeti, and there's thousands of wildebeest. And it made me very excited, but also very sad, because that is a sight. That's probably what the bison look like across the Great Plains, and we'll never
60 million, that's what they think, right? Is that the number?
Yeah.
Okay.
Anyway, that was a digression. So going back, if we look at a natural system, had a balance of nutrients, and then we look at an agronomic system, if we're optimizing microbes to provide nutrients, is that natural? And is it okay if it's not natural? Does that question make sense?
Sure it does. I think that's way out on the...
This is very philosophical, fringe thinking.
Yeah. That's way out there, and those questions we've got to ask. Some would say, didn't the prairie function that way? Where did it get its nitrogen? Did it all come from the bison that passed through?
Right.
Or did it have those microorganisms that produce their own nitrogen that they needed for the rest of the herd in the soil?
Right.
Because we have to have that balance between carbon and nitrogen, and did that happen there?
Right.
And we've slowly taken that away by tilling the soil or growing an agronomic crop.
Yeah. For listeners, Anthony was doing air quotes there.
Farming.
Yeah.
Farming.
Right. Changing the system from native prairie to agronomic system. So there's potential that it is actually the natural cycle or natural system. We just don't know it. I mean, we weren't around, and there are... Pardon my ignorance, but there are probably people that are studying this, and evolutionary biologists and things like that.
We can't keep track of it all, John.
I guess. Wouldn't you love to? So there is potential that, yes, optimizing biological activity to better cycle them for the needs of whatever is growing there. That could be a natural system. We just don't know that, because we don't have the systems in place now.
Well, we know it's there. It's possible, because in some of our agronomic work, we've grown big yields with no inputs. So it does happen, but why it happens and when it's going to happen, we can't necessarily predict.
Gotcha.
We know where it comes from, but what triggers it and when it's going to happen, we can't be for certain.
Gotcha.
And that's one of the big quests of the folks working with nitrogen.
So the last question I asked Eileen is kind of what she's excited about when looking into the future of soil health, and then some of the innovative projects that she's seen or worked on. This is what she had to say.
Well, I'm really focused pretty heavily right now on the whole cover crop area. And although cover crops in some ways have been around for a long, long time, we have new interests in cover crops now than what we had, 30 or 50 or 100 years ago. So trying to determine which cover crops and which cultivars can do which things for us, that's both species-wise as well as variety-wise. And it's a little overwhelming from one standpoint, right? There's lots of different varieties, and they all behave just slightly differently, even for the same species. But I think one of my colleagues used to call it designer cover crops. Right? Trying to find the cover crop to meet the need that the particular need that you have for a particular field, and that fits within your climatic zone as well. I think that's pretty exciting, as well as the whole thing of mixes. There's a lot of hype about mixes that, as far as being good, and in theory, the greater diversity of plant species that you have, the better. But from the practical standpoint, whether, you know, three different species is just as good as 6 or 8 or 10, we don't really have a good feel for. So I think there's a lot of possibilities for that. And if I might just kind of include a little bit of the new technology, this is not something that I do, but there's a lot of people that are working on this. It's the seeding technologies to get seeding to occur at all different times of the year, not just after harvest. One of the constraints to greater adoption of cover crops is that if you don't seed them until after harvest, it's too late for many of the, what I might call, more interesting cover crops, right? About the only thing that's left a lot of times is cereal rye. And cereal rye is great, has a lot of uses, but, you know, there's a lot of more interesting cover crops, but they have to be seeded earlier and have an earlier growth period. So some of the new technologies that are coming up, I mean, the airplane, aerial seeding has been around for a while, but some of these high boy-like seeders that can go through a standing corn crop that's right before ready to be harvested, or some of the seeding technology that'll go into corn when it's, you know, at the 6-leaf stage or something like that, and finding the right cultivar that won't get shaded out and won't compete, or maybe getting it seeded, you know, a little bit earlier with robots that go through the almost mature corn, or drones, you know. So there's people that are trying all kinds of different technologies to get seeding to occur earlier, and to get termination to be a little bit easier to handle in the spring, right? When this, if the soil is really wet in the spring, getting it terminated on a timely basis is also a challenge that worries a lot of farmers. And so I think there's a lot of technologies that are being developed that will allow us to do those kinds of things better. And then that opens up all kinds of windows, I think.
So what do you see in that response as potential for South Dakota or otherwise?
As far as cover crops go, I mean, we're constantly learning. When you talk to the more seasoned producers that grow cover crops, they're adapting and changing and thinking and learning from other producers and trying new things. And we don't know those types of answers.
Sure.
You know, when you could seed the same cover crop blend 5 years in a row and see 5 different results. And why that is happening, because of temperature and moisture and things like that, we don't know.
Well, if we think about mixes, what's your thought on, I guess, species diversity and things like that?
I think it is important.
Okay.
I always think of the famous study from Mandan, North Dakota, where they had single species cover crop seeded and then a blend. And they had a drought occurrence. And the single species were struggling to non-existent, and the blend was happy. Since we don't know exactly,
yeah,
I just think we got to be smart about these things.
Yeah. So then thinking about the, I guess, seeding applications, I guess, do you see that as a potential game changer if we can do better at getting cover crop seed in the ground prior to harvest?
Absolutely. I do. We got to figure out, it's the transition and the overlap of the cash crop and the cover crop. That's what we're trying to learn about.
Right. Because if you do it too early, then you get competition, too much competition, would you say?
Well, we found out that later competition, in fact, I think the insurance companies now realize that later competition isn't a big deal.
Okay. So maybe just going back real quick to this question about, okay, these systems are complex. Will we ever get to the point where we understand it? Or will we just have to be content with managing it in a way that works best for our objectives?
I think we're going to learn to manage it first, and then we'll learn to understand it.
Gotcha.
I think that's going to be the transition. And that kind of goes along with my inorganic to organic agronomy thing. And maybe it's not real right now. Maybe it's too early to even talk about it. Maybe it's 100 years from now. I don't know. It's just a hidden world that's right under our feet.
Well, Anthony, I think that's a good place to stop our discussion for today. We discussed again the relationship between drainage, soil health, some potential issues, some potential benefits, and then kind of some ways that we can think about overcoming hurdles. And so if you, the listener, would like to learn more about soil health or drainage, find us on the STSU Extension website. But for now, I'm John McMain.
And I'm Anthony Vly.
And we'll catch you next time on Streamlines, your source for water knowledge.